Today is Wednesday, August 23rd. We're going to wrap up basic chemistry today with a discussion of organic compounds. All right, so the first kind of chemical reaction you see on the top of page 17 is actually called a neutralization reaction. And if you've ever made a homemade volcano with ingredients like vinegar and baking soda, you've done what's called a neutralization reaction. And thankfully, we can do that at home without any severe consequences because the reaction is not really between strong acids and bases. But if you were to do a reaction between a strong acid and a strong base, you'd have a much more violent reaction, which is why we want to avoid doing those kind of mixtures at home. So the typical neutralization reaction, as you see on the top of page 17, is one that occurs between an acid and a base. Okay, those are your blanks. Neutralization reactions occur between an acid and a base. So this is a great time for us to review. Take this base at the very beginning of the reaction, just by looking at it, how do you know it's a base?
The OH.
The OH, right. Bases release hydroxides or hydroxyls in water, and this OH at the end of the compound is a great clue. Take the acid. How do you know this HCl is an acid? H in the front, right. So what do acids typically release in water? Hydrogens, good. So you can kind of use some shortcut chemistry here and say, okay, there's an H in the front, that one must be an acid. Now the exception, of course, is water. We kind of have to pay attention to that one. Yeah, there's an H in the front, but it's not an acid. Water is, in fact, neutral on the pH scale. What does it mean to be neutral?
It means it's not acidic or basic.
Not acidic, not basic, and it releases equal amounts of what? Yep, hydrogens and hydroxyls. Ah, so if water is neutral, that's why we call this a neutralization reaction. We're actually making something neutral as a result of the acid and base combining. That's not always the case. It's kind of a fudge here to say that it's truly going to make a neutral 7.0 product. But what we're doing is we're going to make something that's neither as strong as the acid or base that were part of the reactants on that other side of the reaction. We also produce a salt. You probably recognize NaCl as plain old table salt, but there's other kinds of salts. So let's kind of go through our checklist here. Does that NaCl contain hydrogen ions? No hydrogen, so it's not an acid, right? Does it contain hydroxides? You have no OH at the rear end, so it's not a base. And by process of elimination, we've checked off that it's not an acid, it's not a base, it's got to be a salt. Yeah. So that's how you figure out if it's a salt. You basically go through your checklist, you say, does it have hydrogens at the front end? No. Does it have hydroxides at the rear end? No. It's not water. Okay, so that leads it to be a salt. That's kind of our shortcut way of figuring out that it classifies as a salt. Okay, so you may wonder why we discuss this in our bodies. For our bodies, it's very important for neutralization reactions to occur to maintain proper blood pH. So what is normal blood pH for us? 7.35 to 7.45. And that is a very tight range of values. Do we consider this pH to be slightly basic or slightly acidic? Basic, yeah. So how did you know that? Past 7, yeah. Just a tad bit above 7, right. So in our bodies, we have these systems of chemicals in our bloodstream that are called buffer systems. And these buffer systems help to nudge that pH back towards 7.35 to 7.45. So that's the whole goal here. This is going to be a topic we revisit come Bio211 because we're going to want to understand how we maintain proper blood pH balance between 7.35 and 7.45. Let me toss out some terms for you. You'll notice that if we fall below 7.35, we develop a blood condition called acidosis. What does that mean is happening to our blood?
More acidic,
good. Let's think of it another way. If you fall below 7.35, is your blood accumulating hydroxides or hydrogen ions?
Hydrogen ions,
right. So this is kind of weird to think of it this way, but an increase in hydrogen ions will cause a decrease in your blood pH. Okay, see how that works? An increase in hydrogens will cause a decrease in blood pH. That leads you into what we call acidosis. Let's do it the other way. If you're heading above 7.45, we say your blood is now heading into alkaline territory. And alkalosis means that we are accumulating what types of ions?
Hydroxides.
Or you could look at it this way. What types of ions do we not have enough of? Hydrogens, yeah. So if you're heading up into alkalosis territory, either you've got one of two problems. You're either accumulating too many hydroxide ions, that's the OH, or you don't have enough hydrogens to balance out the hydroxides you do have. So either way, we can't live too far away from our 7.35 to 7.45 range. Death occurs when we reach around 7.8 and when we fall as low as around 6.8. So there's a lot of mechanisms, including these neutralization reactions, that are going to help try to nudge us back toward our homeostatic range. All right, so what do you think maintains 7.35 to 4.5? Positive feedback or negative feedback?
Negative feedback,
yeah, sure is. Okay, how about questions on acid-base reactions known as neutralization reactions?
You say that acidosis is too many hydrogen ions?
Most likely too many hydrogens, that's right. It could be not enough hydroxides. Most of the time, our problem is getting too many hydrogens, but yeah, it could also be that. Okay, so we're gonna play with baby toys for just a moment. So to kind of start the language here, I want to make sure we're comfortable with four terms: monomer, polymer, reactant, and product. So let's start off with monomer and polymer. Mono as a prefix means how many?
One.
Just single, just one. Polymer?
Many.
Good. So when we're talking about monomers and polymers for organic compounds, we're going to keep those terms in mind. In this chemical reaction, where should I look to find the reactants? Left side or right side?
Left side.
Left side's the reactants. I'm producing products on the right side, and they're the ones that are made by the process of this chemical reaction. So in this particular example, on the left side, we have what's called a polymer, and on the right side, I have individual monomer A, individual monomer B, and individual monomer C. So how do I know that on the left side for my reactants that monomers A, B, and C have been linked together as a polymer?
The lines.
What do those lines indicate? A bond, good. Ionic or covalent? Good. Single, double, or triple covalent?
Single.
Yeah, good. How many pairs of electrons?
One pair.
Yeah, one pair being shared. So that's my clue. I'm looking for something to indicate some type of bond that's been formed there. And so, yeah, A, B, and C on the left side are a polymer because they share electrons. That's what's holding those monomer units together. All right, so just want to make sure we've got kind of a foundation laid here with reactants, products, monomers, and polymers. Before we keep moving, do you have any questions? Good so far? Okay. All right, so down near the bottom of your page, just want to look at types of reactions based on energy in or energy out. We have endergonic reactions that require an input of energy, and we have exergonic reactions that actually produce a net outflow of energy. So endergonic reactions are typically the reactions that require input of energy, and those are our building reactions. I wouldn't memorize this. This is something that really makes sense. You know, in order for your body to grow, you gotta eat, right? So in order to make your body build new molecules, you have to eat, and that food you eat turns into ATP. So, you know, if you just think about it, it does make good sense that what you eat gives you the energy to grow. So all those reactions that make you grow, whether it's, you know, building bone, muscle, new cells, new plasma membranes, you can just keep on listing. All of those building and growing reactions are going to require energy input. That was easy, wasn't it? Okay, so something just to kind of think about, not to memorize. Checking to see if anybody still needs the slide. Y'all good? Okay. So, if it takes energy to grow, then the opposite type of reaction to break down things doesn't require an input of energy. Rather, breaking down molecules in your body actually releases energy, and we call those exergonic reactions. So I kind of think of it this way. If I have a room and I make a mess in that room, give me 5 minutes, I can destroy a room, right? You can tear the heck out of a room in 5 minutes. Come along and you say, okay, time to clean up. You can take 5 hours to clean up that room. So to clean up, to build is an energy intensive process. To tear things down actually releases energy. So no energy input here. In terms of the net production of energy, you actually produce energy when you break down molecules and products in your body. So just something to think about. You know, if you're trying to lose weight, you're actually losing energy. You know, you're generating energy from your body. So it's not that it requires any input of energy for you to lose weight. It's that you're actually generating energy by getting rid of extra body mass. So kind of a concept there to think of. All right, I'm just checking to see if y'all need this slide. Why don't we save activation energy? We're going to come to that in a few minutes when we talk about proteins and enzymes. So we'll come back to this picture in about 20 or 30 minutes. And instead, let's head over to the top of page 18. There, we're going to talk about metabolism. Of your page, you'll notice a definition for metabolism. It is the sum of all chemical reactions in the body. And metabolism is actually broken into two kinds of reactions. Some are called anabolic or anabolism, and others are called catabolic or catabolism. If you've had a chemistry class, they may actually talk about these reactions as being combination or decomposition, so these are other terms that you may have heard of. And your textbook discriminates between anabolic reactions and dehydration synthesis versus catabolic and hydrolysis. Just to make things simple for us, we're going to group them together as the same kinds of reactions. just checking to see if anybody still needs a slide. Okay, so a simple way to think of these reactions, anabolic reactions are ones that build up new things in your body, whether it's new muscle, new cells, new plasma membranes. These kinds of reactions take monomers as our reactants and join them together to make a polymer. If you have trouble keeping these two reactions straight, keep in mind what anabolic steroids will do to a bodybuilder. What do they build for a bodybuilder?
Too much muscle.
Muscle, yeah. So I think of anabolic reactions as ones that build or bulk up body parts, not just muscle, but pretty much anything you want to make or build is considered an anabolic reaction. What's another name for an anabolic reaction?
Dehydration synthesis.
Good, dehydration synthesis, good. And we just got through talking about it. Are anabolic reactions endergonic or exergonic?
Endergonic,
right. They require an input of what?
Energy.
Good. Okay. So with catabolic reactions, catabolism breaks down polymers into their building blocks. So this particular reaction releases energy, and we classify it as? It is hydrolysis, and if it releases energy, it's known as?
It's
exergonic too. Good. So the products this time on the right side of your reaction are monomers. That's our goal here. Break down something, destroy a molecule structure, and create the building blocks or monomers. So I'd also like to point out where water plays a role in these reactions. You've probably heard that it's important to have a certain amount of fluid in your diet every single day. The old adage was something like 64 ounces of fluid per day. You know, you may drink that much on a hot, sunny day. You may not drink that much when you're not so, you know, pressed for getting the fluids in. It just depends on your body's needs. Which one of these reactions requires that you have enough fluid to perform the reaction?
The catabolic reaction.
Good. How do you know water is necessary for that reaction?
Because the polymer plus the water, that is the reactant.
It's a reactant, right? Okay. So the reason you drink enough water every day or some type of fluid is to help break down your polymers into their building blocks or monomers. Good. Interesting to note that the simple fact of building molecules through anabolism, the top reaction up there, makes a small amount of water. I do want to caution you, that's not enough water to live off of. It's around 150 milliliters or so per day. And that's not really enough to drive these breakdown reactions that are constantly occurring. So it takes more like a liter or more of fluids per day to help break down those chemical reactions. All right, so let's take this one. This is, of course, a building reaction. We call it dehydration synthesis. And just to kind of appreciate what you're looking at here, where are the reactants?
Left
side, good. So A plus B plus C, those are our reactants. And our product over here on the right side includes A bonded to B, bonded to C.
Plus water.
Plus water, good. So that's what we're doing. We're taking building blocks or units. We're going to join them together in this reaction. And in doing so, we dehydrate these molecules. Dehydrate, there's our clue word, right? We dehydrate these molecules and we drive off the water that serves to protect those molecules. We have to show that we did that. We have to show that we drove off and dehydrated water. So that's why it shows up down here as a product. It was removed or dehydrated from the reactants here. So when you think about the word dehydration synthesis, we dehydrate or remove water from our reactants. We place water as a product. And then the second part of the word there, synthesis, means what?
Make.
Yeah. So we literally dehydrate our monomers so that we can make, there's our word, right? So we can make a polymer, okay? So in our bodies, can you think of an example that falls into this category? What might you make, build, or grow every single day? Bones,
muscle,
Air. Yeah. Every 2 to 3 weeks, the lining of your esophagus has to be replaced with new cells. Every 30 to 50 days, your skin is completely brand new at the surface level. We're constantly making or building new items. So this particular reaction requires input of energy. It is endergonic. And the products of a dehydration synthesis reaction are what? Polymers or monomers?
Polymers,
right. Okay, and by contrast, if you're going to break down items, this time we're going to take our polymer, which is A bonded to B, bonded to C. We're going to use water to break apart these bonds. And of course, that water comes from your bloodstream. It comes from interstitial fluids. And it comes from the fluids that you drink, whether in your diet or, you know, part of your foods that you eat. And that breaks up our polymer into individual monomer pieces. Okay? So this is something you're probably really familiar with. What does this kind of reaction sound like?
Digesting food.
Yeah, digesting food. Good. This is a great example of digesting food. And if you're lucky enough to lose some weight, this is how you do it, right? You take molecules of fat or protein, you break them apart using water, and you get them into monomers. Okay, so digestion is a fantastic example of how we break apart polymers into monomers. So is dehydration synthesis, is it exergonic or endergonic?
Endergonic,
good. How about this reaction here, hydrolysis?
Exergonic.
It's exergonic, good. And just to kind of make a point, hydrolysis, hydro is water, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is lysis?
Break down,
split, rupture, all those are good. So what are we breaking down?
Water.
And the polymer and the monomers, yeah. So when you think about the term hydrolysis, it really tells you, hey, we're using water to break down, and we're breaking down polymers into monomers. So we're going to use our new terminology and actually go through the organic compounds. And we'll talk about hydrolysis, or literally breaking polymers into monomers and vice versa. How about questions so far? I know chemistry is not everybody's favorite subject, so let me pause here. I've got, what, 5 examples for you. Let me give you a moment to see if you can classify these as an anabolic or as catabolic. And if you want to work with somebody, you're welcome to.
Like all your skin.
Had a chance to answer all five? Ready for answers? Okay. Who wants to tackle the first one? Soaking dirty dishes in a sink full of water.
Catabolic.
Why is it catabolic? Good. Breaking down. Right. So we know the trick, right? Leave your dishes overnight, come back, they're clean. So yeah, you know the basis for catabolism. That's what breaks apart those food particles. All right. How about the second one? Baking a cake.
Anabolic.
Good, anabolic. Why is it anabolic?
Because you add a quarter or two to the cake, makes you be able to make the cake.
You mix the ingredients, you put the cake, this is critical, right, in the oven. Water evaporates, right, right. Because if you come back an hour later, you open the oven door, your face is hit with steam, that was the dehydration of the water. Exactly right, good. Next one's a little more scientific. Glucose added to fructose yields sucrose and water. There's your clue, right? So what kind is that?
That's catabolic.
It's
catabolic.
That's an antibiotic.
Because you're taking out the water.
Taking out the water. Yeah. It's anabolic. All right, so that means that glucose and fructose are monomers, and sucrose is polymer. Yeah, and by removing water, you're making a dehydration synthesis reaction. Any questions on that third one?
What was the monomer?
Glucose and fructose are the monomers, and then sucrose is a polymer. Digesting food, how about this one?
That's catabolic.
Catabolic, good. Breaking down. And of course, this time, where is water? Reactant or product?
It's reactant.
Got a drink when you eat because it helps break down those food particles, right? Okay. And then finally, growing new skin.
That's
anabolic. Good. What was the clue word?
Growing.
Yep. Good. So that's a good clue. Feel better? Feel worse? A little better? Okay. Looks like we're ready for carbs, lipids, proteins, and nucleic acids. And this information begins over on page 19. Let's see, Monday we talked about the inorganic compound category, and now we're talking about organic compounds, so we want to see the difference between these two categories. We know that organic compounds are molecules that are made by the human body. That's the typical way we see them occur in nature. And they oftentimes have lots of carbons and hydrogens. Long chains may exist here with things like oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur all linked together. So we consider these organic molecules to be macromolecules. What is macro as a prefix?
Big,
yeah. So a lot of these are really big molecules. All right, so just to contrast this to Monday's discussion of inorganic compounds will not have the long chains of carbons and hydrogens that we see here, and they often do not exist as macromolecules. Likewise, inorganic compounds are held together most often by what type of bond?
An ionic.
Ionic, yeah. So just something to kind of consider when we think about the difference between these kinds of molecules. So can you tell me the four major organic compound categories?
Carbohydrates, lipids, proteins,
and
nucleic acids.
That's it. Carbs, lipids, proteins, nucleic acids. Okay. Just checking to see if anybody still needs this slide. Almost, okay. This vibrating screen drive you guys nuts.
Yes.
Okay, I'm gonna complain again because I complained last year they didn't do anything, but I can't even look. It's like, ugh. It's like it's gonna give me a seizure if I look at it, you know? I can't imagine having to sit here and look at the screen constantly moving, so. Good to go. Anybody else need the screen, the slide? Okay. Just to kind of put this in perspective, you know, when we think about eating food, we eat it, we break it down through catabolic reactions, and then we take the ingredients and we build them back up to make our own bodies. You know, the old saying is you are what you eat. No joke, you know, we do take all the building blocks from foods that we eat and reassemble them into our own body parts. So, you know, if you're eating a lot of protein, then that's what we can make with those monomers or building blocks. Interesting to note, you know, you guys told me the four organic compound groups also includes the nucleic acids, but when you look at any food label on any box of food from the grocery store, there's no nucleic acids, yeah. So, interesting that they just put fats, carbs, and proteins on there, and you might think that nucleic acids aren't necessary, but in fact, we do use them. Make our DNA, exactly. I don't know. People may not eat, like, cow, chicken, or something else if they knew they were getting the DNA in their bodies. I don't know. It might freak people out. But you are. You're getting all those molecules, and we build our own DNA, RNA, and ATP from what we eat. So carbs are our first group, and before we go any further than just the word carbohydrate, let's break the word down. The word carbohydrate has carbon, okay? What about hydrate? Yeah, it's actually water. So what are the components of water? Hydrogen and oxygen, yeah. So right there in the name, you've got the ingredients of a carbohydrate. You've got carbons, and hydrate means water, so you've got hydrogens and oxygens. In fact, your typical carbohydrate is going to have a ratio like this. You're going to have twice the hydrogens as you do carbons and oxygens. So pretty much any carb that you look at is going to have this basic ratio, twice the hydrogens as carbons and oxygens. We think of carbs as our fuel source. You know, the simple sugars give us a great burst of energy. They give us a quick burn of fuel. The more complex carbs may take longer for us to burn off, but still, that's the whole point of a carb, is to provide ATP. There are three categories here: monosaccharides, disaccharides, and polysaccharides. Our building blocks fall in the monosaccharide category. How did you know that? What is mono?
One.
Yeah, that's our unit, right? so the building block of this category is known as a monosaccharide. Monosaccharides are quickest to burn. They have between 3 and 7 carbon atoms. And glucose is a great example of a monosaccharide. It has 6 carbon atoms. So it fits the bill, right? If you're a monosaccharide, you have between 3 and 7 carbon atoms. Glucose has 6. I just want to introduce you to organic chemistry structure. You're actually familiar with what you're looking at. You probably haven't seen it as a ring before unless you've taken a class, maybe Bio 110, where they showed you the ring structure of a molecule. Well, normally glucose is laid out like this when we talk about, you know, molecules, and you can actually see that there are carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens all held together by what types of bonds? Yeah, for the most part it's single covalent. But then, in fact, glucose prefers to coil up into a ring structure, which is classic organic chemistry. And you'll notice that we still have those single covalent bonds holding together the carbons and those hydrogens.
They're just aligned in a different shape.
They're just aligned in a different shape, that's right. And I like that they numbered them for us. There are, in fact, 6 carbon atoms, which falls in that range of being a monosaccharide. So this glucose molecule, in fact, is our preferred fuel for making what?
Energy.
Yeah, ATP energy. So glucose is a monosaccharide, and so are its isomers. So what is an isomer? Iso means same.
Different structures.
Different structures, right. So they have the same chemical formula. They just happen to have a different structure. By the way, the formula from our glucose is this. Good. So there you go. You got C6H12O6. Does that fit the bill for your typical monosaccharide or carb? Yeah, it falls into that CH2O, that basic ratio. So, in fact, galactose is an isomer of glucose. It has the same chemical formula, C6H12O6. The catch is, you think you'll notice there the slightly different rotation for hydrogen and the hydroxide. On the left side here, they're flip-flopped from glucose. Cool thing is, your body knows the difference. Your body says, oh, wait a minute, you don't look exactly like glucose. You're something different. I prefer to have glucose over galactose, and in fact, your body will burn glucose before it burns galactose because it takes a little shift in that chemistry to make it readily available. Same thing here. Fructose, this one here on the right, is actually a got a pentagon shape, kind of a different rotation, you might say, for those molecules. But here we've got more of a six-sided ring structure for glucose, and again, that is big difference for your body. Your body says, hey, that fructose is not the same structure as glucose. The body prefers to use glucose to make ATP. You know, you may have seen a lot of food products in the grocery store that say no high fructose corn syrup on it. And you may wonder, well, you know, why does it matter? Why does it matter? Well, why do we think it matters? It's a different sugar, right? And we think that your brain get satisfied if you have glucose. So they think, and this is kind of all out there still in research, that if you eat fructose-based foods, that your body's not quite as satisfied and won't necessarily be satiated from having had foods with high fructose corn syrup. But for our purposes in here, fructose, like galactose, is an isomer of glucose. What do they share in common? Same formula, different structure. Okay, so same formula, different structure. All right, so if we take two glucose molecules and we join them together, doing so, we're moving water, we're going to generate a polymer known as maltose in this example, and this actually builds a more complex sugar. Is this an example of dehydration synthesis or hydrolysis?
Dehydration synthesis.
dehydration, synthesis, right. So in fact, a couple of examples of disaccharides on your worksheet there are maltose and what else?
Sucrose.
Good. What is sucrose built from?
Glucose.
Yeah, glucose and fructose. Good. You know, interesting stuff out there. Some babies are born with an inability to digest fructose. And we have to identify this from the onset, you know, from day one, because if they're given fructose, then they're not able to digest and break down that sugar. So could a baby who can't eat fructose be given sucrose? Why not?
It's
got fructose in it, right. So it's important for people who have a condition called fructosemia to not consume fructose or even sucrose, since it's built from that molecule. All right, so we've got two disaccharides so far. We've got maltose and sucrose. Notice the trend, OSE. What does that tell you? Sugar. Yep, OSE says, I'm a sugar. Okay, if you're having, you know, brain overload at this point from all these OS words, let me give you a helpful hint. Notice the GNF words, glucose, galactose, fructose, are monosaccharides. And then there's no GNF words down there for disaccharides, right? There's maltose and sucrose. Okay, so just an observation there. And then finally, you've got polysaccharides, which are more complex. We consider them our complex carbs. And there you've got three examples. They are glycogen,
starch,
yeah. Which ones are plant polysaccharides?
Cellulose and starch.
Yes, cellulose and starch. And the only one in animals is glycogen. Okay. Let me introduce glycogen. It is a complex carb. It gives you a longer burn of energy, and it's made up of many units of glucose molecules. Each one of these little six-sided green things here is a glucose molecule. Oh boy, that packs a lot of energy. Your body stores glycogen in your liver and in your muscles for about a couple of days, maybe 2 or 3 days. So let me put it to you this way. If you go to Krispy Kreme, well, they had those chocolate donuts Monday, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I missed. Too bad I missed that. Let's say that, makes my mouth water. Let's say you went to Krispy Kreme and you had you some of those chocolate donuts on Monday and you ate too many of them and your body says, it's okay, I'll store this extra sugar for you for later. Your body says, I'll store this extra sugar as glycogen. What hormone does that job? Insulin, yeah. Insulin comes from your pancreas. Yeah, comes from your pancreas. That's right. Glycogen can be stored in the liver. So that was Monday. You had all those donuts, and you stored that extra sugar as glycogen. And now here it is Wednesday, and maybe you're feeling kind of guilty, like, well, I ate the whole box, and I'm kind of feeling bad. So you've got about 2 to 3 days to burn off your glycogen before it becomes fat. Yeah. So if you go back and pull that glycogen from your liver and your muscles, then you can break it back down into sugar. Every one of those molecules there can break down to a glucose for you. So that's the thing about glycogen. We store it for around 2 to 3 days, and then, of course, your body says, I've been holding this for you. You didn't come back and get it, so I'm going to turn it into fat for you. So now, by Friday, if you haven't burned off those donuts from Monday, it's fat. Yeah, so it's not an immediate thing for you. Oh my God, you gained 5 pounds from eating donuts on Monday. It takes a delay for your body to do the chemistry. Okay, so glycogen is an animal storage product. I do want to emphasize glycogen is not fat, but if you don't use it, that is the next step. It becomes fat. Let's see, starch. What are some foods that are good sources of starch? Potatoes, pasta, breads, yeah, rice. They say all the foods that are white in color are the ones to avoid eating. Well, it depends. If you want to have a longer burn of energy, then starch is a great source for you. But if you don't plan on burning off all that energy, what happens to the glucose when it gets in your body? It goes to fat. Yes, it goes to that same method of glucose stored as glycogen and then glycogen stored as fat. Starches are also made of glucose. These six-sided rings here are glucose molecules. You break them down through catabolic reactions. You then have glucose to give yourself energy. If you don't burn off all that glucose, your body says, I'll store this extra glucose as glycogen. After about 3 days, it becomes fat. So you probably heard of this thing called the freshman 15. It's more like the freshman 45. You go to college cafeterias and restaurants are full of taste good, feel good carbs. And so they have pasta bars, potato bars, pizza buffets.
Making me hungry.
I know. Here it is lunchtime. We're all going to be having to leave to eat. Chinese food with all those noodles and rice. All those carbs, if you don't burn them, get stored as glycogen and then eventually as fat. Yeah. Now, there is another carb here called cellulose. OSE says, hey, I'm a sugar, so of course it falls in the category. But there's something about cellulose. We don't have enzymes to break it down. So, you know, eat all the cellulose you want. It's not necessarily going to contribute to weight gain, because what happens to cellulose that you eat?
It just
comes in and goes right back out, right? What do we call this? Yeah, for corn, yeah. What do we call this?
Fiber.
Yeah, this is fiber. So we can't digest cellulose, therefore it passes through your body relatively undigested. And, of course, it does increase the speed at which your bowels move and push out those undigested food waste. So, yes, cellulose can be pretty harsh in our intestines. It can hold water with it, which is the nature of fiber, which increases the bulk of your feces. Now I'm not hungry anymore. Not talking about that. Okay.
But that's where your greens come from. Right?
That's where your greens come from. Yeah, corn and leafy greens are great examples here. I'm just kind of thinking outside the box for just a moment. If you're going to run a marathon, would you rather have something like a breakfast of glucose or galactose? Or perhaps would you like sucrose or maltose? Or would you like a breakfast of starch?
Starch.
Why? Last you longer, right. So every single glucose molecule has to be hydrolyzed or broken apart, and that's going to take some time. What if you did eat a breakfast of glucose before a big event like a marathon?
You'd get some quick energy, but it'd burn out on about the halfway mark.
Yeah, you'd feel good for the first mile or two, right?
Then you feel miserable.
Then you feel miserable, yeah. You'd pass everybody in the first mile or two.
But then they'd be passing you.
They'd be passing you, yeah. That's the only, there you said you had your donuts for breakfast, right? But they were good. So, yeah, starch.
At least you burned them all before the first.
That's true. But you got 3 days. It's a countdown, right? It's a starch. It's kind of like a big log on a fire. It's going to be a better source for giving you a long-term burn of energy. Okay. All right. So how about questions on carbs on page 19? Is this stuff brand new? Is this stuff old?
It's a mix.
It's a mix.
Yeah.
Okay.
It might as well be brand new.
Better bit here than never, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Y'all stop me if it doesn't, okay? Lipids are our next category, and you know, they kind of get a bad reputation because, you know, you hear the word fat and it makes you want to like shiver and hide. No, not fats, anything but fats. But they're actually very necessary for our bodies. You'll notice that they form all sorts of things, from plasma membrane structure. They form the basis for sex hormones. They are incredibly important parts of our bodies, but they do get a bad reputation. We're going to talk about how they function as fats, as phospholipids, and as steroids. And yeah, we do know they insulate. They do provide an energy storage mechanism, but they're so much more complex than just that. y'all still need this slide? Okay. Compound, and we say that they are made up of chains of carbons and hydrogens. This is what should come to mind. Look at all those carbons and hydrogens that form the basis for a fat. This portion here is considered the glycerol head, and all of our fats, well, most of our fats, have a long fatty acid chain that we call a tail. So when you think about organic compounds versus inorganic compounds, this is the picture, this is the poster child for organic compounds that should pop in mind. Okay, so the glycerol portion of your typical fatty acid is going to be a hydrophilic portion. That hydrophilic portion is one that loves water. And the tails, however, are hydrophobic, meaning that they don't get along well with water. So when we're thinking back to some old terminology, we know that water is polar, right? Okay, so what does it mean to be polar?
It's polar, it means that it'll mix with water.
Unequal sharing of electrons, polar molecules get along with other polar molecules, but they don't get along with non-polar molecules. So understanding that, which portion of your fat tends to be polar? The head. Yeah, the head happens to be polar. The head gets along well with water, which is polar. The tails, however, because they don't get along with water, they're classified as what?
Non-polar.
They're non-polar. Good. So when we talk about fats, because their heads are all the same, we don't really talk about how the glycerol head differs because they're the same from one fat to the next. Instead, when we talk about fats, we talk about how their tails or fatty acid chains differ. Okay, so what we're looking at here are these fatty acid chains and how they're structured. On your worksheet, middle of the page there, you'll notice there's two ways to describe the fatty acid chains. We can describe them as saturated or unsaturated. Good. Saturated fatty acid chains have a maximum number of hydrogens bonded to the fatty acid chain. I'm glad they color-coded this portion red because we're going to ignore that first portion. There's an oxygen double bonded to a carbon and an oxygen and a hydrogen. We're going to ignore that part right there. Instead, we're going to focus on the rest here, which is in black font, and those are the carbons and hydrogens that form the fatty acid chain. So since we have a hydrogen in every possible space available, we say that this fatty acid chain is saturated or full of hydrogens, okay? So in terms of food groups, what kinds of fats would you consider to be saturated?
Butter.
What's that? Let's see, stuff that tastes good, which is lard, butter, fat like bacon grease, you know, it turns solid at room temperature. So all those things they say not to cook with, oh boy, those are saturated fats. And of course they turn solid at room temperature. Unsaturated fats are healthier for us because they're liquid at room temperature, and more importantly, they do not have the maximum number of hydrogens bonded to their fatty acid chains. You can see here that we have a number of carbons and a number of hydrogens, but there's actually a pair of hydrogens missing. Because carbon aims to have a stable valence shell, it'll double bond with itself. So these double bonds create kinks in the fatty acid chains of unsaturated fats, and those kinks will actually trap air spaces. That's why we find unsaturated fats to be liquid at room temperature, like pretty much any type of oil that you can think of. Canola, vegetables, sunflower, corn oil, all of those are missing hydrogens and pack less energy than a saturated fat. Okay, so just for an example, ignore this part here on the left and instead focus on the fatty acid chain. Do you notice that there are missing places where we could have put some hydrogens?
Yeah.
Okay, so that area where you're missing hydrogens will form a double bond between the carbons and the chain will kink or bend. And that kinkiness is what traps air pockets between molecules and gives us a liquid at room temperature. Okay, and then again for comparison, here's a saturated fat. Every possible seat is occupied by a hydrogen, and of course that makes for a solid room temp. So, bottom line, saturated fats are unhealthier than unsaturated fats. Why is that? They hold a lot more hydrogens, right? Okay, so saturated fats hold a lot more hydrogens and they power pack more energy. You know, a lot more energy stored in those fatty acid chains. In fact, we can also further classify these as mono unsaturated, poly unsaturated fats, just to give it a little more clarity. If you have a mono unsaturated fat, there is only one double bond, okay? And I know it's hard to see this detail of the structure here, but I'm looking for a single kink in the fatty acid chain. Which one of these three is only kinked once? The middle one, yeah, oleic acid, right. So this one here is missing hydrogens right there, and it kinks one time. That's because there's a double bond. We classify that one as a mono unsaturated fat. Polyunsaturated fats have many double bonds. How do I know which one of these is polyunsaturated?
Far right.
Far right, yeah, and it's very kinked, right? Every kink represents a double bond between the carbons, and what am I missing from the fatty acid chain?
The hydrogens.
The hydrogens, yeah. And then just for the sake of identifying everybody, steric at the very beginning here, mono, polyunsaturated, or simply saturated? What do you think?
It's saturated.
It's saturated. How do you know? Yeah, no kinks in the chain. All the carbons and hydrogens are filling every space possible. And so it is the one that power packs the most energy storage. If you're reading food labels, which one of the three is the worst selection? The first one, because it packs so much energy. And your healthiest choice? The last one. Yeah, linolenic is your best choice. Why is that?
Because it's easier to break it down.
Easiest to break it down, yeah. It has less hydrogens on the fatty acid chain. Best way to break it down. I encourage you to look at the food labels. Next time you're in the grocery store, take a look at margarine or any kind of semi-solid product like margarine. And read the food labels. I guarantee you'll find some of these on those food product labels. So kind of feel empowered when you go in the grocery store and know what that stuff means. Sometimes they'll list them by name. Sometimes they'll simply say monounsaturated fats or polyunsaturated. So now we kind of understand the difference between those. Let's see. Let me flip you on over to page 21. How about questions on 20? So here we have glycerides, and we're through talking about the type of fatty acid chain. Now we're turning our attention to the number of fatty acid chains per glycerol head. If you have one glycerol head bound to one fatty acid chain, we're going to call that a monoglyceride. Okay? If you have two fatty acid chains bound to the head, we call that a diglyceride. All right, so you're blank there. Is two fatty acid chains. So again, I encourage you to read food labels just for fun, if nothing else. Monoglycerides have only one fatty acid chain per head. Diglycerides have two fatty acid chains per head. You've just doubled the energy storage, right? And what about a triglyceride?
Tripled it.
Yep. So now you've got three fatty acid chains per head. And so this is the max amount that you can put on there. These three fatty acid chains also happen to be saturated. How do you know that from looking at the picture?
All
the hydrogens are filling every space possible, and there's no kinkiness in that double, no double bonds. Yeah.
It's probably the best place to one out of the three.
It probably is. You'd be most satisfied eating a triglyceride, right? Kind of interesting side note, if you have a blood test done, they may run a test and test your triglyceride levels in your bloodstream. And what they're looking at is how much fat you have floating. And the potential there is for how much heart damage or cardiovascular damage you can incur. The younger you are, the better your body is at handling these triglycerides. The older you are, the less capable your body is of handling these. So your body ends up leaving these in vessels. They can harden your vessels and cause cardiovascular risk to increase. Heart attack, yes, stroke, things like that. Let's see, middle of your page there, phospholipids. Phospholipids, well, it's just a lipid with a phosphorus group, right? And these are special because they form the plasma membrane of every cell in your body. You may recognize what you're looking at. There's your glycerol head, and there's two fatty acid chains. One is straight, fully saturated. The other one is what? Unsaturated, right. Would you consider it to be mono or polyunsaturated?
Mono.
You've got one double bond there causing a kink in that chain. So yeah, these are the ones that form our plasma membrane structures. They form a bilayer. You'll notice their heads are oriented outward and their tails are oriented inward together. Outside is hydrophilic, yeah, and the inside is hydrophobic. Yep. You may have an old course pack. I took out these echinocyanoids. So if you do happen to have an old course pack, maybe a borrowed from somebody, you can cross that stuff out. I'm going to move you next to steroids. Okay, and some textbooks consider steroids to be so different that they should belong in their own category, but they've been historically grouped together with other lipids. And so we're going to look at steroids as a type of a lipid for that purpose then. What you're looking at are four rings. You know, they get lazy with this organic chemistry stuff. They stop putting a carbon at every point at this bend, but in fact there is a carbon at every time you bend one of these molecules. So, what's that?
Every one of the points.
Every one of the points, yeah, is a carbon. So instead of cluttering up, they just take the carbons out and they just make these ring structures. This is the basis of cholesterol. Cholesterol, of course, is a steroid. And cholesterol, like we see here, happens to be the basis for a lot of things in our bodies, including plasma membrane structure and sex hormones. So cholesterol gets a bad reputation because it can be trapped in our vessels, it can clog our vessels, but it's certainly a very important type of steroid for us to have. Interesting to note, 85% of the cholesterol you make genetically, you know, you're programmed to make it, only 15% you can alter through your diet. So if you happen to have high cholesterol, you can eat lettuce every day, all day, but you got to look at your genes. That's where the underlying basis for how you make cholesterol comes from. All right, so that takes us down there to the bottom of page 21. How about any questions on carbs or lipids so far? Got a few minutes left. Let's see what we can do to start the proteins. All right, so what is the monomer or building block here? Good. And what are some of the things that proteins do for our bodies? They do structures, they do hormones,
enzymes.
Good. We actually classify them as structural proteins or as functional proteins. If they're structural, they do exactly as the name implies. They build some structures. And if they're functional, then they serve some purpose. Okay, so we can actually group our proteins into one or both of these categories. Checking to see if y'all still need the slide. Looks like a lot of still copying. Okay, why don't we put a note here that we're going to start with protein structure, middle of the page. We'll do that on Monday. And my goal on Monday is to move you into chapter 3. Do go ahead and read through organelles if you have a chance. And we're going to start talking about DNA, RNA, protein synthesis, all that good stuff will come on Monday. Y'all have a great weekend.